writing and music.
I've set a lot of poets, and some of it has been thrilling for me, setting the words of Anne Sexton, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and wonderful and very dark. I found my way into that poetry and almost couldn't climb out.
That's composer Roger Ames talking about setting the poetry of Anne Sexton to music for his Requiem for Our Times. We'll talk with him about his latest projects, a piece in honor of Leonard Bernstein, and a musical, How Green Was My Valley.
Yiddish was essentially a modern literature. It emerges in the late 19th century when the traditional Jewish world begins to unravel, and Jews suddenly confront the whole panoply of modern institutions. And as they do so, certain writers begin writing in Yiddish to figure out what it means to reconstruct Jewish identity.
And that's Aaron Lansky of the Yiddish Book Center. We air a 2006 interview with him about his memoir, Outwitting History. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When I was invited by film and theater director Mira Bank to interview composer Roger Ames, I wasn't sure it was something that would be right for the show. Although songwriters have been guests on Writer's Voice, I'd never thought to talk to someone who writes music. But I sure am glad that I was smart enough to go outside my self-imposed box for what turned out to be a fascinating conversation about writing music, especially for voice, and hence words, and also about Ames's latest work, which he wrote for a group of terrifically talented young musicians, all high school students from Long Island. We also talked about another exciting project he's working on, a musical based on the book How Green Was My Valley. Ames has written numerous operas and musicals. He won a Pulitzer for Requiem for Our Times. He was commissioned to do his latest piece by Mira Bank and her husband, playwright Richard Brockman. They founded the Playhouse Project to mentor young musicians, and the name is inspired by the Elizabethan-style theater they own in East Hampton, Long Island. I came to the theater during a practice session by the musicians to sit down with Roger Ames and find out all about the Playhouse Project and the piece he wrote for it, Laudate Dominum.
This is called the Playhouse Project. You can find it on Google by just doing playhouseproject.org. It takes place in East Hampton at one of the beautiful classic mansions on the lanes headed towards the sea, Hunting Lane. It is a house of Tudor inspiration, although I think it was built probably in the late 19th century. It has a music room as the center of the house. It was always meant to be a theater or a music room. It wasn't built to impress the royalty of the Hamptons. It was built to have entertainment, theatrical and musical. It lay fallow for many years. When Richard Brockman and Mira Bank took over possession of the mansion, one of the things, I think this is true, this is my understanding, they wanted to activate the energy of the room again. And they did it, bless their hearts, the same way Leonard Bernstein would have probably done it. They've reached out to teenagers. And they give teenagers money, scholarships for music school. They have competitions. They have master classes. They have events like this where they'll bring teenagers from all over Suffolk County. And now in my area in Nassau County, to get together and make music with great musicians. This piece, we got Mira and Richard and Jeffrey and I were talking around their picnic table about Leonard Bernstein. We are, I think, of the same generation. I'm not sure of that, but it feels like we are. And we were talking about what an influence Bernstein had on us, particularly as teenagers. And that was, for us, the era when he first took over the New York Philharmonic. But he had already written West Side Story. We all loved West Side Story, and we didn't know his more significant or serious music efforts. And Mira, I think, said, or maybe it was Jeffrey, said, why don't we get a piece that honors him? And I said, man, I'd love to write that piece. I never had a chance to thank him. I wanted to study with him, and I couldn't get there. But and so we talked about that, and they were pleased with the idea of a tribute to him. Then it was a question of finding the right text. And the Laudate Dominum is a text that, simplistically, I would say, pleads for world justice. And that was one of the things we all admired about Bernstein, was his willingness to raise his fist in the air for poor people and for African Americans and for people who were not treated well, including, of course, his famous concert at the Berlin Wall when the Berlin Wall fell down. So he was a missionary of his own right. So I wanted that text, and that text I felt dealt with one side of Leonard Bernstein, and then in researching.
Wait, let me interrupt you there. Say more about this, about Leonard Bernstein. I don't think a lot of us know that. I didn't. I mean, I went to Bernstein's young people concerts. That's always what I associate with him. Going to see Stravinsky's Firebird Suite that was conducted by him, and finding the little feather, the little golden feather under the seat. I mean, I must have been all of 7 years old. Oh. So say more about Bernstein's love for justice.
Well, he was he was reprimanded, I should say, by many people of the, should I say, classical music culture for speaking on behalf of the Black Panthers, for example. When the Civil Rights Movement was going on, he was very outspoken about justice for the poor and for the racially condemned, and went as far as doing active work for the Panthers. That got him in some trouble with his benefactors, but he kept doing it. And not that I could cite dozens of situations, but wherever there was some, you know, when Kennedy was shot, when Robert was assassinated, when Martin Luther King was, Bernstein was there. He would conduct memorial masses, but he was in the center of a very compassionate, almost desperately compassionate cause, which extended to the free world versus the communist world. And he played in that field all the time.
I interrupted you. So you were talking about then another aspect?
Well, he's also, if you went to the young people's concerts, he had a sense of humor, which was remarkable. And one of the quotes that he that I found, actually, let me find it here, I thought would be a lot of fun to put in a tribute piece to him. And the quote is, "To achieve great things, two things are needed, a plan and not quite enough time." And Bernstein was noted as a musician as being pretty flamboyant and in a way, he brought an energy into the room that you never knew what to expect when he was there. It made some critics crazy. It made musicians who worked with him adore him. He was impetuous and intuitive and passionate at every turn, you know, imbued with passion. And so I was really interested in setting this quote, because I think that was the other side of him, the serious, wonderful musician, humanitarian, and then there's this guy who just will jump into a room and have a party. And he was also notorious for that. He would party late into the night after his performances.
So is there joy in your piece?
Oh, there is, yeah. There's a lot of joy. What I tried to capture was a sense of awe about his spirit and the power that he had both as a teacher and as a musician, and certainly a sense of joy and how much joy he gave us.
Are you influenced musically by Bernstein?
Oh, in this piece I am. Absolutely. Any one who loves Bernstein will hear snitches here and there. And I did it on purpose. And I should just say I gave myself permission to write the kind of music that he might have written. And you know what? A composer struggles his or her whole life finding their own voice. My struggle has always been not to write Leonard Bernstein's music. I love it so much. And so this avoidance, this purposeful avoidance of copying him has always been with me for decades. So now when I got permission, I had a ball.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Roger Ames about writing music. I spoke with him at the Home and Theater of Mira Bank and Richard Brockman in East Hampton, New York, where he was working with conductor Jeffrey Simon in helping a group of gifted young musicians bring his new piece to life, Laudate Dominum, a piece created in honor of Leonard Bernstein. You're listening to a clip from the Playhouse Project performance of Laudate Dominum. Thought about this idea of writing music and how similar or different is it, and you think, in your process, than somebody who's writing words?
Almost all the music I write is for the stage or for voices, certainly. And I have to say that my first response to that question would be that I admire writers to the ends of the earth, because I regard vocal music, music that's sung, as worthless without words. I mean, people have written for voices without words, but by and large, most of us who write for voices need the words. And I, although I love poetry and I love lyrics, and I've tried it myself many times, and sometimes had a little bit of success, my admiration for writers comes from I regard my work as responsive to their work. I don't regard myself as a principal creator. I am a responsive creator. It is the writer who brings the energy to the work, and I react.
So you're saying you set your music to words, not words to music?
Almost always it's words first, yeah.
And how is that? I mean, what is that process, that creative process of getting words? I mean, I'm not sure, maybe you can't explain it, but it's always been something that I've been curious about, is what is the process of setting music to words?
I can explain how I begin. After that, it gets a little confusing even for me. And I've tried to trace this process. And you know, lots of really well-known composers have, I mean, Richard Strauss wrote an opera about it as to whether, you know, the words were more important or the music is more important. But I think for my own work, creative work, what the words show me is the path to the music. And my duty as a musician is to try to find the honest emotional qualities that exist in the poem or the lyric, and then to deepen that experience, that emotional experience, because I think that's what music generally does, and if it's done well.
It adds emotion.
Yeah. Well, it adds emotion, and in a way, it takes us out of our intellectual response to words, and it brings words directly to us in a way that has its own power. And you know, it's interesting because I've said a lot of poets And my some of it has been thrilling for me, setting the words of Anne Sexton, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and a wonderful and very dark. I found my way into that poetry and almost couldn't climb out. So touched was I by the honesty and the raw brutality and the transcendent quality of what she was writing. And a lot of composers get mad at me because I don't think ever that songwriters or composers who set other people's words should do anything but share the credit. And I think, you know, historically, composers have gotten credit for a lot of work that writers had a very big role in.
What did you set to music of Anne Sexton's?
Actually, the piece that was nominated for the Pulitzer, Requiem for Our Time, takes a good many of her later poems, her what I call her death poetry, and juxtaposes it along with the Latin Requiem Mass.
So you said you almost couldn't climb out of that. Could you say a little bit more about that? What does that mean for you?
There's a very delicate balance. I think all creative artists go through it between finding the one needs to be balanced. My job is to find the, as I said, the highest emotionality I can find. But sometimes when you find that, it can plunge you to depths that you don't necessarily want to be in. And I mean, Anne Sexton committed suicide, so there you have it. And I fully understood why by the time I'd studied her work. And I think I tried to put in the work, in my work, in musicalizing her texts, I tried to find compassion for where she had written to, as opposed to imagine what it was like to be in her head and heart. I think if I'd done that, it would have been just too much.
Shakespeare said, music knits up the raveled sleeve of care, but what you're describing here is that it can also lead one to despair.
Yes, exactly. That's a nice Shakespeare quote. And I do think that, but I also do think that if one reads Sexton's poems that I used, and then one hears this particular piece of music, one would have a very deep sense of compassion for her, which was my intention, that was to create empathy and understanding. My son lost 3 teenage friends through suicide, so it was for me a personal journey to try to figure out what that meant to us and what it meant to us who were left behind. And as a matter of fact, Linda Sexton, Anne Sexton's daughter, and I have become quite close through this project, because Linda was the daughter who was left behind. And so when we were talking about Sexton's work and my wanting to have permission to set it, she wanted to make sure that it was a compassionate setting and not a brutal, exploitive, dramatic setting.
And so how did that relationship that you made around the music, how did she respond to the work that you did?
She loves the work.
We're talking with composer Roger Ames about writing music. He's working on a new musical. Are you working on some other pieces at this point?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, the Mira Bank is also one of the artistic directors of play readings at the Actors Studio in New York City. And she has become such a wonderful supporter of ours. My wife, Elizabeth Bassine, and I are working on a musical based on How Green Was My Valley, the classic novel and, of course, John Ford movie. And we had a reading there just a few months ago, partly in thanks to Mira's support. So that's what we're working on right now. We're looking for producers.
It seems like musicals are experiencing a revival. You know, the great era of musicals, of course, was back in the 50s and 60s.
Back in Leonard Bernstein's time. Well, it's a very interesting struggle, as anybody who's been in the business knows. There's a lot of pop music, a lot of and I don't want to be a snot about this, but the music in many of the Broadway shows that are running now is not necessarily the featured highlight of musicals at this point. And one of the things we took on when we decided to write How Green Was My Valley was actually to look at the classic musical with a big sprawling book and with singers who really sing and with music that really goes deeply into the emotional world. And, of course, How Green Was My Valley takes place in Wales, where they sing like no other.
In Wales, they sing?
Oh, yeah, the Welsh male choruses have one of the great musical energies in the world. And so we deliberately chose that subject to try to create a big, sprawling, classic book musical. And we're getting a lot of support for it. We had wonderful response in New York, actually.
You mean wonderful response in terms of...
We invited audiences in to hear the reading, and we had a wonderful response. It's probably a $20 million musical, so in this economy, it's been a struggle to get going, but we're still going.
You're still working on, you're still rehearsing and still writing?
Oh, yeah. We just finished extensive revisions after the reading, and this was the interest of your writer audience, because our book writer is Ron Hutchinson, who's an Emmy Award-winning writer, mostly for television, who claims that if he had a chance, this would be what he'd do his entire life.
Writing musicals.
He, however, discovered when we had the reading at the Actors Studio that he felt the book, although he's a great playwright, he has plays all over the place, he's Irish himself, and has many plays running in England, has had a couple of Broadway successes. He felt that there was too much book. And he actually went back to L.A. after the reading, and he sent us about 10 days later a revised version of the musical where he turned over many of the wonderful scenes in the book to us and said, make this music.
And what do you feel about that?
Well, at first we resisted because he's written a beautiful book. And then... Elizabeth, who was a lyricist and a beautiful poet herself, began to look at it, and we talked ourselves into trying it and said, at least we can do is try it. And he was right. He was right. He's created now. He's helped us reweave the story in a way that's even more connected and more passionate and more moving.
So you have a playwright, you have a lyricist, and then the composer.
Right. Classic team.
Is that difficult to weave all those different strands together?
It's a challenge sometimes. Although I have to say the collaboration up to this point has been remarkable. I've music directed every one of the classics at one point or other, and I have such admiration for those teams, Lerner and Lowe, My Fair Lady, Camelot. And although I don't want to say that we've imitated it, because the story itself of How Green Was My Valley is Welsh and takes place in the mines of Wales at a dark time in their history when the mines were falling apart and killing people all over the place. The story is also wonderfully uplifting because it's about a family struggle to maintain real connection and sanity in a time of such trial. And in that sense, it is, it's very much like what would be the best, like South Pacific, where you have this beautiful story and you have this very, very serious account of people's confronting their demons, and you end up with that beautiful show.
So, for those out there who turn their noses up at musicals, the classic musicals and now you writing musicals. What do you say to them in terms of the quality of music itself? You know, before you said Bernstein, he wrote West Side Story and, you know, also wrote wonderful serious music within quotations. You know, is the quality an issue at all?
Well, I think it's a big issue, and I will acknowledge that we've had some pretty important people look at our work so far, and their first response was the music is too lush and serious, the lyrics are too poetic, the story is too dark. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you do when you get a response like that? The lyrics are too poetic, the music is too lush, and the story is too dark. What you get is that's the commercial mind trying to figure out whether an audience will buy into a piece like this and part with a lot of money to see it. We have no idea whether an audience will do that. But probably many who are out in our audience right now listening know that that film still carries a clout. When people go and watch that film, whether it's on their TV or in a theater somewhere.
How Green Was My Valley?
Yes, How Green Was My Valley. It has a power that's transcendent, and it's a story does. And given this world we're in with minors, we're watching minors being killed all the time, and the problems, the sociological, political problems that exist around mining are almost as bad today as they were then. Nobody's really solved this. People still spend their lives day after day after day under the ground, sometimes a half mile, trying to eke out a living for their family and don't know what their alternative is. And that's exactly one of the reasons, one of the big reasons why we chose to do this piece.
And you're pretty passionate about this. What brought you to this story?
Many things. I've known some miners. I knew someone quite well who died at age 54 of black lung disease. I was in my 40s at the time. I thought that was about 40 years too soon.
Was that a family member?
A relative, yeah.
And in doing the music, how has this process been for you? Has it been smooth, easy sailing, or have there been things that you've struggled with?
I would suggest that it's a classic musical in that it's probably 2.5 hours long. Right now, the list of songs comes to 27, although some of those are reprises or different versions of the same song. And we've probably written nearly twice that many songs and then thrown them out or drastically changed them because we felt we could tell the story better doing it slightly differently. So revision, as writers know, I mean, it never ends.
And finally, what's been the best part about this process so far for you?
Writers of all types, composers too, who work simply because they need to do it or they'd shrivel up and waste away. That's how I feel. So that anytime I get an opportunity, whether it's a friend who wants me to do something or it's like Richard and Mira who are actually paying money to have me do it. Or if it's somebody in Minnesota that calls me up and said, we'd like to do this piece. It becomes for me, I can go up. Let's go to the next round. Let's write this one and move on to the next one. And I think the musical, How Green Was My Valley, was simply something that needed to be done. It just needs to be done.
Roger Ames, thanks so much for a terrific interview. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
We're talking with composer Roger Ames about writing music. He's working on a new musical, an adaptation of Richard Llewellyn's How Green Was My Valley. The musical is a form he especially loves. Roger Ames. He's written operas and musicals for numerous American opera companies, London Fringe, and the Hartford Stage. Ames won the Pulitzer Prize for setting the poetry of Anne Sexton to music in his Requiem for Our Times. Here's a clip from one of the songs in How Green Was My Valley. You can hear more by going to writersvoice.net. And Stay tuned for Aaron Lansky after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Hanukkah is this week. I celebrated it with my six-year-old granddaughter. We made a menorah out of Play-Doh, lit the candles, did the blessings, ate the potato pancakes, told the story of the Maccabees, spun the dreidel for chocolate coins, and gave presents. The whole nine yards. My granddaughter lives in Brooklyn, one of the last places on the planet where a whole community speaks Yiddish as their native language. But Yiddish is experiencing a revival, with young and old taking classes, reading Yiddish literature, and listening to klezmer music. I think it's safe to say that the Yiddish revival was sparked by my guest, Aaron Lansky. He's director of the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. For the last 25 years, he's been on the road to rescue the world's abandoned Yiddish books. His center has rescued some more than a million of them, and become a center for Yiddish revival, with classes, exhibitions, plays, and film showings, all in a collection of buildings on the campus of Hampshire College that resembles a shtetl of old. I spoke with Aaron Lansky in 2006 about his memoir, Outwitting History. I asked him to tell us something about the history of Yiddish.
Yiddish was essentially a modern literature. It emerges in the late 19th century when the traditional Jewish world begins to unravel, a world rooted in Talmudic law, and begins to unravel, and Jews suddenly confront not only Enlightenment, but the whole panoply of modern institutions. And as they do so, certain writers begin writing in Yiddish to figure out what it means to reconstruct Jewish identity in a modern context. And the result is Yiddish literature. Something like 25 to 30,000 discrete titles come pouring out between, oh, let's say the mid-1860s, and certainly up until 39 and even after that. It was the single most concentrated outpouring of literary creativity in the whole of Jewish history. And yet, despite the importance of the literature and also just the sheer excellence of the literature, it's really readable, it's really funny, it's compelling, it's passionate, it's tragic, it's got it all. Despite all of that, a new generation came along, and because of simply the historical currents in America, the kids and certainly the grandchildren couldn't read these books any longer. So an older generation would pass on, books would be abandoned, and the result of it was that these books ended up scattered literally in attics and in basements all over the United States and around the world. So I set out to try to rescue these old books before it was too late. This started out when I was still a graduate student in Montreal back in the late 1970s. At the time, I thought I was taking a two-year leave of absence from graduate school to save the world's Yiddish books. Here we are 25 years later, and we've saved 1.5 million volumes, and I'm still on leave from graduate school.
It's clearly been a labor of love. I wonder if you could talk more about your love for the language and how you came to it. What was your part of that journey?
Well, I grew up in a way that was probably quite typical of most American Jews. Not only was I American born, but my parents were as well. When I was a kid, Yiddish was fairly ubiquitous among older people, I mean, I'd say among Jewish immigrants when I was young. But I heard Yiddish spoken essentially when I wasn't supposed to understand what was being said. Things didn't change for me until I went off to college. I enrolled in Hampshire College in 1973. In my very first semester there, I enrolled in a course on the Nazi Holocaust, organized by Hampshire students and taught by the very best people in the field. It was the first time the Holocaust had ever been offered as a college course in America, which is also interesting because today these courses are absolutely everywhere, colleges, even high schools today. But back then it was brand new, so the best scholars in the whole country came to do the teaching. And by the end of that first semester, I found myself less interested in the Holocaust per se, and far more interested in who were these Jews that the Nazis had sought to destroy? Or to put it another way, what was there about Jewish culture in Europe that was so antithetical to fascist ideology that the Germans were literally willing to lose the war in order to pursue the destruction of the Jewish people? Now, it just so happened that the faculty advisor for the course was the dean of social science at Hampshire, a man named Leonard Glick. Len was an anthropologist by training, also a physician. And because he was an anthropologist, he naturally asked what today we would call social historical questions. That is to say, you know, well, who were these Jews in Europe, and how were they actually living their lives? And, of course, once one asked those questions, the simple truth is that for the last 1,000 years, something like 80% of the world's Jews were living their lives in Yiddish. So although I took courses in Hebrew and in German, which was kind of the prescribed course of study at the time, I also realized that I needed to know Yiddish. I found a professor at the University of Massachusetts named Jules Picus. Jules was a professor of medieval Spanish literature. He knew something like 20 languages. He had absolutely encyclopedic knowledge of pretty much everything. And he loved the Yiddish that he remembered from his youth, and he agreed to teach me and two other students. We used to go to him at 5 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. We'd bring with us a bottle of wine and a loaf of homemade bread, and as long as that lasted, he would teach us. And after 2 or 3 years of that, we were reasonably fluent in the language.
You set out to rescue Yiddish books before they disappeared. And you began, well, in 1980, you know, it's interesting that you talk about that being the first course on the Holocaust. It's almost as if it had to skip a generation in some ways. You are the second generation after World War II.
Yeah, but I'm 49. I'll come right out with it, and then we'll know where I stand.
Right. But it still took decades before the world was really willing to even look at this. And have you seen this? Do you feel that what you've done has been a part of this?
I do. But, you know, Francesca, it's not that hard to understand in a way, because if you think of the historical magnitude of what happened during the Holocaust, you know, 1 out of every 2 Yiddish-speaking Jews in the world was murdered in the space of 6 years. If one begins to understand that, it's only natural that it took a few decades or that it took a generation of recoiling from that incredibly painful memory of what had happened before we can begin to come to terms with the culture that was destroyed or to come to terms with what was lost, before we can really begin to understand all of this. You know, for the most part, Jews in America are still on the stage now of just beginning to acknowledge it all in the sense of building monuments and memorials. That's happening now. Mm-hmm. We're only really at the very first stage, though, I think, of beginning to understand what had been lost altogether. So there's an awful lot of work yet to be done. But, you know, there's this wonderful midrash, there's a wonderful rabbinic commentary mm-hmm. that explains why it was that when the Jews left Egypt, they had to wander 40 years in the desert. And they said, you know, so what happened? You know, Moses got blunted, he got lost in the desert. Why did it take 40 years? Why did they have to hang out there all that time? And what the rabbis say is, oh, it's because a new generation had to come along that was untouched by the trauma of slavery before Jews could enter the new world or could move on to the next stage in their existence. And I think this is not entirely unlike that. I think a new generation just necessarily had to come along that could finally, you know, free enough from the trauma of what had happened to begin to come to terms with what was lost.
Has your goal changed over time that you've been doing this work?
It hasn't changed, but it's deepened over time. You know, when I first started out, the goal was really straightforward. It was just to save books that were literally being destroyed. We knew that every day older people were dying, books were ending up in garbage cans and in dumpsters and in basements. And, you know, something had to be done very quickly to save this literature before it was too late. But times moved on. And we have saved, you know, 1.5 million books. It's more than I can even begin to describe, you know, exactly what that means. And we've digitized that literature. And we're placing copies of Yiddish books in libraries all over the world. So for the most part, and actually we're even about to place the entirety, the content of most Yiddish books online, so to be fully searchable by computer, for free by any internet user anywhere in the world, which will put Yiddish literally in the forefront of scholarship generally in terms of accessibility to a literature. So all that's being done. But what that means is that once the books are safeguarded, once we know that the books we've collected are going to be secure and accessible forever, we then have to move on to the next obvious stage, which is, so all right, how do you open up these books and share the content with the broader world, knowing that most people nowadays, both Jews and non-Jews alike, can't read Yiddish in the original anymore. So obviously translation is the first part of it. We're now spearheading a project called the New Yiddish Library. where we're systematically trying to commission translators around the world to translate the best works of modern Yiddish literature into English, and they're being published through Yale University Press. And pretty much all the major Yiddish scholars around the world are involved in one way or another in the trying to figure out, you know, what's out there. At this point, 0.5% of Yiddish books have been translated into English. You know, 1 out of 200. So imagine what lies, you know, hidden in those other 199 books, you know, out of every that haven't been translated yet, for every one that has. So that's one project. But the even bigger project is the fact that, all right, so how do you let people know what's there? And in that sense, our biggest energy right now is reaching out to college students who have the intellectual grasp to begin to come to terms with the content of the literature, the intellectual sophistication to do that, but for the most part know nothing about it. You know, we have people all the time come into our headquarters here in Amherst on the Hampshire College campus, and they walk into this building and they look out over the sea of books. I can't tell you how many times I've heard this. They say, who knew? You know, who knew that such a literature existed? Because it hasn't been taught. It's almost as though we threw out 1,000 years of our history without discussion and without deliberation, and it simply was lost to sight. And now is the time to come to begin to reclaim and figure out what lies inside. So in that sense, I'd say we have, as hard as we've worked over the last 25 years rescuing a literature, we have a much bigger job in front of us now.
You're hearing a 2006 interview with Aaron Lansky about his book, Outwitting History. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. Yeah, now I'm really excited to begin to read some of that literature myself. I mean, I know German, so I found myself sounding out the Yiddish quotes throughout the book just to see what I could understand.
So how did you do?
Well, I did pretty good once I got the spelling differences.
Right, right.
But I was surprised to find the sound to be really beautiful. And I wonder if you could read us a short selection, like the poem on page 76 or something else like
sure.
that?
Sure, I'm happy to read for you. This is a poem that's actually chilling in its prescience because it was a poem that was written not during the Holocaust, but actually in the late 1930s, before the Nazi invasion of Poland, written by a wonderful Yiddish poet named Mordechai Gebirtik. And he wrote about the fate of a shtetl that was, as he says, zerbrennt, that is burning, and again, written before the real cataclysm finally descended. And I'll read it to you first in Yiddish, and then I'll translate it for you. Es brennt, briedelich es brennt, oi unser orem shtetl nebuch brennt. So haben schon die Feier zungen, das ganze shtetl eingeschlungen, und die Bäse winden hunden, this ganze shtetl brennt. On fire, brothers, it's on fire. Oh, our poor little village is on fire. Tongues of flame are wildly leaping. Through our town the flames are sweeping, and the cruel winds keep it burning. The whole town's on fire. Well, the real immigration started actually even before that. In 1881 was when the Russian Tsar, Alexander II, was assassinated. And the Tsarist government tried to redirect popular disaffection by blaming everything on the Jews and imposing very strict anti-Jewish disabilities, at which point the Jews began leaving in large numbers for America. And that continued. You're right, in 1903 was the huge pogrom in Kishinev, in a city in Bessarabia. And then after that, of course, after the failure of the 1905 revolution, once again everything was blamed on the Jews. And after 1905, an even greater number of Jews started coming to America. So, you know, unlike many immigrants came to America looking for opportunity, for Jews it was a little different. They certainly were looking for opportunity, but far more than that, they were simply looking for physical survival.
And yet they established such an amazingly flourishing culture and a literature here. And what was very interesting to me in reading your book is how connected the culture of Yiddishkeit, I guess if I can use that term, really was with the whole progressive and enlightenment agenda. I mean, we don't think, or I have never thought of Yiddish as a modern literature because somehow I just always connected it to medieval Jews.
Yeah, well, it's because, you know, the language was spoken for 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, it's almost by definition a modern literature. Prior to the mid-19th century, let's say, prior to that time, the only writing that existed in Yiddish was what used to be called Weibertheitsch, or translation for women who were not expected to learn Hebrew. Other than that, educated men would have known Hebrew and to a lesser extent Aramaic. And most writing was scholarly and legalistic and was done in Hebrew. There really wasn't much room for literature, as such, for modern novels and so forth. In the 19th century, when the old world began to break down, when Enlightenment, makes its way into Eastern Europe, what happened was at first Jewish intellectuals turned to Hebrew, which was a classical language. Don't forget, commencement addresses at Harvard University in the 17th century were given in Hebrew. It was a classical language in that sense. Even today, the seal of Yale University has Hebrew written on it. But the only trouble with using Hebrew to spread enlightenment was that most Jews couldn't read or at least couldn't understand the language. And so very reluctantly, some Jewish intellectuals began writing in Yiddish as a pragmatic way of reaching the Jewish masses. But you know what they say, the medium is the message, right? Before they knew what happened, the more they imitated that folk voice, that populist voice, the more they began to become attuned to the social needs of working class poor and working class Jews as well. And so within a very short time, that implicit social theory is transformed, and soon Yiddish becomes very closely allied to the emerging Jewish labor movement in Eastern Europe. It was the language of the Jewish proletariat as such. And when Jews came to America, even more so, huge population, completely displaced. I remember my own grandmother who came from, a moderately well-to-do family. Parents were furriers in Galicia, fled, came to America. And I remember her telling me she was 16 years old, stuck working in a sweatshop in New York City, and she was sewing, muffs, where people used to stick their hands in these to stay warm. She was sewing muffs, and she was forced to work on Shabbos, on the Jewish Sabbath, because that was simply what was required of the workers. It was a six-day work week. And she said that the first time she ever had to work on Shabbos, she was crying so hard that she was soaking the cloth that she was trying to sew, and everything was wet all day long. Well, that's a very touching story, but it's also a telling story because it shows the sort of disruption in traditional Jewish life that took place. And once that happened, and Jews had to figure out, what do we do now? Where do we go from here? They then turned to the secular Yiddish press and to secular modern Jewish literature as a way of finding their way in this very confusing new world. And it was from that Yiddish literature came bursting forth with such power.
Lansky says that while the Jews of the Yiddish world distinguished between the spheres of religion and daily life, Hebrew, for example, is the language of prayer, while Yiddish is the language of the everyday, these two spheres were not opposed to each other.
What was so interesting about Jewishness is that these were not opposites. Rather, it was a constant dialectic between the two, between the holy and the everyday. Can I give you one example, and you'll get what I'm talking mm-hmm. about? There are many old Jewish proverbs which begin in Hebrew and then end in Yiddish. And watch what the Yiddish does. For example, there'll be one that says, Ato bichatonu mikol ho'amim, which is very nice highfalutin Hebrew, which says, Thou hast chosen us from amongst the nations. But in Yiddish it ends, Tavos hast du gewollt von dein Volk Yisrael. How come you had to pick on us Jews? it's in the juxtaposition that it finds its energy and its motive force. Now, that being said, what happened? Jews come to America, and the deal in America in the early 20th century was religious difference was okay. You had Episcopalians, and you had Congregationalists, and you had even Unitarians. That was okay, and Jews could fit into that by having a different religion. But cultural diversity and, God forbid, linguistic diversity, these were simply anathema. That wasn't part of the American ethos at that time in history. So as a result, what Jews did is very quickly they tried to take this broad dialectical tradition and just reduce it to religion alone. And it could be a modernized religion, as you say, such as Reformed Judaism, which has its origins in Germany. But nonetheless, it becomes a religion like every other. And the whole cultural sphere was quickly discarded because it was something too anti-American or unassimilated about all of that. So at precisely the moment when this literature and culture are bursting forth, at that precise moment, Jews are also trying very hard to Americanize. Now, I have to say, it wasn't such a bad deal. I mean, look, we made it here. Mm-hmm. We're affluent. We're well-educated. We became part of a broader polity. All that's unprecedented in Jewish history. So I'm not exactly complaining about all this. But I would say that we lost the sense of our totality that gave us so much oomph to begin with. And it's time to begin reclaiming that. Now, the Hasidic world is another story entirely. That which is demographically is a very small percentage of American Jews. Nonetheless, the Hasidic world continued to maintain Yiddish as a spoken language. And they were able to do so because, for them, the social circumstances which brought Yiddish to birth still prevailed, which is to say, they were largely sequestered community. They wanted to live a life unto themselves in their own world, so why not have their own language? The only problem is that the Hasidim, at the same time, were hostile to Yiddish literature, because I said to you before, Yiddish literature represents a way of living in a modern world. So they speak Yiddish, but they won't read the kinds of books that we've saved.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all pretty complicated, but you got the lay of the land, I hope. Yeah,
I certainly do. And and actually, you say toward the end of your book that you say that Jewishness, and by this I kind of feel you mean Yiddishness, has more to say than ever before. And, you know, in the context of what you just said, I mean, here we live in a time when religious fundamentalism is pretty rife, but we also live in a multicultural society which is struggling with a lot of these issues of kind of integration and difference. So do you feel that this Jewishness can have more to say than ever before to non-Jews as well, to the larger society?
Oh, yeah. First, let me say, I love multiculturalism. You know, I'm thrilled to live in a country that has the kind of unity and the kind of universal acceptance that we have in America. On the other hand, the more diversity, the better. You know, go out to eat in New York City and look at the choice of restaurants that you have. You know, there was just an article in the Times recently that said that in 25 years ago when Zagat's was published, I think there were 32 different cuisines that they identified. Mm-hmm. And today that number's up to close to 100 and something, you know. the truth is, it's great. You know, of course diversity is a wonderful thing. But Jews have to play their own stake in that admixture. And the truth is, we have an awful lot to add. And the reason I think we have more to say than ever before is twofold. One, we've lived on the outside of European civilization for 1,000 years. And as outsiders, one develops a certain perspective and a certain point of view that's very important to have, because you see things from another perspective. And we also come from a tradition which has a core culture rooted in ancient Hebrew texts, with a very strong and profound prophetic tradition. And what Yiddish does is to take that tradition and bring it down to earth. So the truth of the matter is, you know, Yiddish is sort of prophecy in practice, if you will, you know, or
what do you mean by that?
Well, it's a moral vision translated into the terms and sensibility of everyday life. And as I say, not for abstract reason, but for reasons of survival. Because when you're a small and vulnerable people, unless you live in a world where there's justice, you'll be the first victim of injustice. Unless you live in a world where peace prevails, you'll be the first victim of war. And that's certainly been true historically.
Yeah.
So it means we have a lot to say that we've learned a lot along the way. And in some sense, our condition is now universalized. You know, certainly with nuclear weapons, that means that, you know, everybody's a potential victim. Mm. You know, war now would mean that not just some, you know, small group out in the middle of nowhere is going to get it. The truth is that ultimately it can mean that we're all potentially in danger. And therefore, we've all been sort of Judaized to that degree. Mm-hmm. We all share that experience of constant vulnerability and therefore constant vigilance to create a world that's simply more decent, more just, more human, and more peaceful.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're airing a 2006 interview with Aaron Lansky of the Yiddish Book Center about his memoir, Outwitting History. You had some really wonderful experiences, incredible adventures, as you say in the title of the book, and it's really true. I wonder if you could tell us what was maybe the most amazing anecdote that you remember out of that. What was the most important experience that helped you to understand what you were doing?
I'll tell you one story that's probably emblematic of what was happening that gave me greater understanding. There used to be an old building in New York City. I think it was on 76th, I think. It was a big, tall building. It was a home to many of the old socialist Jewish Yiddish cultural organizations, the magazine called The Future, the archive of the Jewish Labor Bund in Russia and Poland, and a whole bunch of other, you know, similar sorts of institutions. The building was owned by a foundation, and it had become very valuable over the years. The real estate had become very valuable. And for a number of years, I had heard rumors that the foundation that owned it was planning to sell it and relocate these organizations to much less expensive and less commodious space downtown somewhere. Well, I heard this, and every time I would call up one of the organizations, they'd say, you know, they were very defensive, and they'd say, no, there's no truth to it whatsoever. You know, we're here for good. Nobody's moving us. Until one day, I get a phone call. This was the Monday before Thanksgiving, and the man says, all right, it's true. They're moving us out. We're moving right now. We have to be out by Wednesday before Thanksgiving. There are thousands and thousands of books we're leaving behind. You have to come right away and get the books. So I said, oh, you know, what planning, right? So I went down. We arranged to rent a very large Ryder truck down in New York. Meantime, a friend and I left Amherst. We stopped at Bread and Circus. We got a few sandwiches. My friend was driving. We came over the hill over the Connecticut River there, and just as we came over the rise of the hill, a car going quite fast crossed over the center lane, ran into us head-on at 35 miles an hour. We all ended up in the hospital. You know, it was really pretty harrowing. So we had to postpone things by yet another day, and a day later I make my way down to New York with bandaged ribs, and I show up at this building along with a bunch of coworkers. And we started, you know, making our way through the building. By this point, the people were gone, and almost all the furniture was being moved out. And there were big, burly movers, you know, moving out the last of the material there. But we were there to take the books, which was literally strewn all over the floors of this building. We started in the sub-basement. We started making our way up. It wasn't until quite late that I finally made my way towards the top of the floor of the building. I'm just going to see if I can find this for you, because I'd love to be... I'll just read this short passage for you. It said, our truck was almost full, and the sun beginning to set, when we finally reached the top floor. I was alone, deeply absorbed in my work, collecting what books and papers I could find, when suddenly I came upon a large roll-top desk that had not yet been removed, and seated behind it, a very old man reading a newspaper. He looked up, and we stared at each other for a long time. Here I was, a young man with a beard, long hair, jeans, and a dirty sweatshirt, carrying an armful of Yiddish books. And there was he, a small man at a big desk in an otherwise empty building, silhouetted against a small arched window, looking as though he had stepped straight from the pages of a novel by Isaac Bashevis Singer. It was he who broke the silence. There's Idea. Who are you? He gruffly demanded. I told him. And who are you? I asked in return. Yudshin Hertz, he said. Well, I have to tell you, I'll break from the text for a second. Yudshin Hertz, I was just astonished at this, because Hertz was the author of the official history of the Jewish labor movement in Russia and Poland, a four-volume work that I had read in graduate school, very well known to me. But I had assumed that he must have died, you know, many years before. So for me, this was like someone coming out of a legend from another world. So I'll return to the text. Suspicious at first, Mr. Hertz was astonished and then clearly pleased when I told him that his books were still being read. He was 92 years old, he told me, and at his age it was too late for change. Although he knew the building was being emptied, he had decided to remain at his desk until the movers, or whoever was in charge, actually looked him in the eye and ordered him out. I left him there alone at his desk, leaving it to someone with a less acute sense of history to persuade him to leave. Although I was often exasperated by what I perceived as the stubbornness and intransigence of the old Yiddish world, I found myself rooting for Mr. Hertz in his lonely vigil in that darkling room. His determination struck me not so much as obstinacy as nobility, the Don Quixote of the Atron House attic, resolute against the inexorability of change, the last defender of a world that was literally being pulled out from under him. But even before I passed the burly movers on their way up the stairs, I knew that Mr. Hertz's cause was lost. For as he sat at his roll-top desk, digging in his heels and waiting to do battle with history, the newspaper he was reading was not the Yiddish language Forvitz. It was the English language New York Times.
Aaron Lansky, reading from Outwitting History. You can hear him reading more from the book by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.